We're going to turn to Matthew chapter 28, verse 11. Now, this is the most famous commissioning text in the Bible that people turn to. But we're going to start in verse 11. Now, when I was, and I'm thankful for the folks who run the sound and run the PowerPoint. We've got a brand new PowerPoint or presentation software, and Kelly learned it on the fly. Because it's brand new, though, I didn't pull in all the scripture. So I'm going to start in verse 11, but we're not going to have it up there until you get to verse 16. So if you didn't bring your Bible, you're just going to have to trust me for those first five verses, okay? So we're going to start Matthew 28, 11 through 20. 28, 11 through 20. The most famous commissioning text of all the Bible. We've actually even named it the Great Commission. Now, that's not actually in the text. We added that to it, but this is what it says. Matthew 28, 11 through 20. While the women were on their way, now what is just, let me just set the stage in case you're curious, what has just happened? Jesus has just risen, and now Rome's in an uproar because they don't know what to do. The Jewish community's in an uproar because they don't know what to do, and so this is where we pick it up. While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. So the women are on their way to tell the disciples. And when the chief priests had met with the elders, they devised a plan. They gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." And so the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. Matthew doesn't talk a whole lot about what happened in Jesus' ministry after he rose from the dead. Because then it goes straight into, "And then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. And when they saw him, they worshiped him. But some doubted. And then Jesus came to them and said, 'All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. And therefore go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age.'" This is the text. And this is how Matthew ends his gospel, with this Jesus telling them to go. This is the part of the discipleship process where Jesus is telling us to go and make other disciples. I've heard it preached from churches, pulpits before, where he says, "Go and tell people about Jesus." So there is another Great Commission. There's a Great Commission text in Luke, and he says something very similar but a little different. But the emphasis here is on making disciples. Go and make disciples. Not converts, not additions to our club, but to go and make disciples, because this discipleship-making process was God's plan for church growth, to spread his love, to spread the gospel. It's what Jesus modeled. Jesus took 12 guys, poured his life into them for 3 years. But because Jesus created disciples, instead of just adding members to his club, because there was lots of people he could have added, just a handful of chapters earlier, we see where 5,000 people were following Jesus because they wanted to see what the show was. Jesus was more interested in making disciples, people whose lives were genuinely changed. This was God's plan for growth and multiplication of his gospel. It wasn't through addition, but it was through multiplication. The reason I want to start here, because there's other pieces of this text that we're going to pull out, but I want to start here because in evangelical Christianity, we have celebrated and pumped up evangelistic techniques and numbers and different types of things to say, "Hey, I had this many at church. Hey, we had this many come forward on an altar call." Billy Graham, you know, publishes that number. And even Billy Graham, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, says of all the people that come, they estimate that only 2% of them actually become followers of Christ. Like, genuinely, you know, like they get past that initial conversion experience and actually become disciples. And we don't celebrate the discipleship process because we can't really see it. It's slow. It's difficult. It's spending time with someone. But I want to pull out in the next few minutes why this, I think, is really important before we go any further in this. Because I really think that if a church will focus more on discipleship than we do on creating really cool environments to draw people in and add numbers and say we had a blah, 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 blah number of people at church this morning. But if we can like get past, and I'm not saying it's bad, I'm just saying if we can get past that and not make that our sole focus and focus on discipleship, that what we'll see is exponential growth, a multiplication growth, not an addition growth. If the church will focus more on discipleship, then we win the quality side of that Christian conversion. But we also win the number side of it too, eventually. And again, I'm not negating, I just want to stop right here and say I'm not negating or devaluing evangelism. It's needed. In fact, we're going to talk in a week about witnessing. It's needed. Like God told us to go and tell, but he also told us to go and make disciples. But the thing is, if we're creating disciples, then evangelism just happens as a byproduct of our love for God. Like if we're creating people who love Jesus as much as we do, they're going to tell people. It's not something we have to manufacture. It's not something we have to create. It happens. It's a natural outflow. The early church, Peter stood up on the day of Pentecost and just told all he knew. And Peter didn't know a whole lot at that point. But he stood up and said, this I know. This guy did this and he died. But he rose again and this is what we believed. And the Bible said that God added 3,000 people to their thing. But the early church was more focused on discipleship because they had just heard Jesus tell them to go and make disciples. When they heard that, that was Jesus saying, go and make yourselves, reduplicate yourselves. And they knew what it was to be a disciple. They had just experienced what Jesus did when he discipled them. I think part of the problem is we don't really know what discipleship looks like because we haven't really experienced it very well in our lives. But they knew, like Jesus poured into them. And so that's what they were going to do. We read a lot of Paul's letters. Those are discipling letters. Those are letters he didn't write to a broad congregation generally. He wrote to specific people within those congregations. He names them a lot of times and says, hey, remember, I taught you this. He's having to constantly remind them. He's having to constantly model it for them. And it's not a sexy kind of glitz and glamour and lights and music and all this cool stuff. And people come and it's exciting for a day and then it goes away. But it's sustainable. I worked in student ministry for a long time. And then I worked kind of in a family ministry type of role. But when I was in student ministry, there was one moniker that we lived by. And it was the moniker of what you win people with is what you win people to. If you win people with lights and sound and glitz and glamour and all this stuff, that's what you won them to. And that stuff goes away. Discipleship, if you can win them with Jesus, that doesn't go away. And that's where we, and I'm telling you guys this, and it's good as I look around. It's not good, but as I look around, we have no visitors this morning. That's all right. Because this is kind of a talk between us. Like this is where we want to be. We want to be a church that disciples people. Because what I want you to see is the church was just simply reproducing themselves, the early church, the disciples. They were just simply reproducing themselves. That's all they were doing. And God brought the increase. It was just like a tree bearing fruit. There's a guy that I used to follow a little bit when I was in my undergrad degree, in my graduate degree, my master's degree in seminary, and he would say, you never pass by an apple tree and hear it straining to pass fruit. Which I always laughed at. It's a silly analogy, but it was true. An apple tree just naturally produced fruit. It just happened. And when these disciples were just reproducing themselves, it just happened naturally, which takes the strain away. We don't have to worry about what do we have to do to create church growth? What do we have to do to add to our numbers? We just have to be faithful and reduplicate ourselves. When I was a kid, my dad, and you guys have probably done this, my dad gave me this little word problem, and I was... This was just who I am. In fact, if my wife is here, she may not even believe this story because it's probably not who I am today, but it's a true story. My dad said, what would you rather have? $1 million right on the spot, $100 a day for the rest of your life, or a penny every day and double the penny, a penny the first day and double the penny, and double your amount every day for a month. And that was it. I'm like, are you kidding me, man? And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm probably taking $1 million. Now, if I had to go do it over again, looking at it now, I'd probably have been like, I'd probably take $100 a day for the rest of my life. And my dad said, just go and figure it out. So I sat down with it. I literally remember it. And my dad keeps everything, so it may still be somewhere at my mom and dad's house. But I took a yellow legal pad, and I put, okay, one penny times two. I got 2 pennies. Now double that. All right, I got 4 pennies. At the end of a week, I only had like 52 cents or something. I don't remember what it was. But at the end of the month, it was like two figures higher. It was like 2 decimal points higher than a trillion. Like, I don't even know what that means. I don't know what that word is. It was astronomical. I mean, I started getting up to past like 15 days. I'm like, oh my goodness, never mind that. I think I'm changing my mind. Like, I'm just going. And I was like, holy cow, this is nuts. Because it was this idea that multiplication, while it's slower and less sexy on the front end, on the back end, you win the multiplication process. I mean, you win the numbers game as well, because it was an astronomical thing. So I heard this illustration. I'm going to bring it out just to make a point one last time. There was an evangelist, and he spent his ministry, 25-year ministry, and every year 5,000 people came to know Christ. It's amazing. Every year. At the end of his ministry, if that was true, at the end of his ministry, he would have led 125,000 people to Christ, which is great. But if we take the same guy and all we ask him to do is just once a year reduplicate yourself just to one person. So every year you pour to somebody, you create this disciple. And then the next year you do the same thing. At the end of that ministry, he's only personally touched 25 people. But if the person he does the same thing, and those guys do the same thing, at the end of a 25-year ministry, that impact is 33.5 million people, as opposed to 125,000. Not that 125,000 is bad, but multiplication is better. And that's what God has called us to. He's a God that's asked us to multiply ourselves, not just add converts to his club, not just to bring in people in the door so we can go and brag about how many people we had at church, but to multiply ourselves, to pour in them, and to take these principles that we're going to learn over the next 8 weeks, apply them to our lives, and then invest them in someone else. As a parent, I'm not called to parent every kid in the world, right? I'm called to parent Jude and Ben, and then the other kids that God brings our way. And then at that point, develop them to the point that when they become adults, if they choose to, they can be fruitful parents who can do the same thing. It's a multiplication process. And that's a lot different than a lot of churches are trying to do now. They're fighting and striving to grow, to gain cultural relevance. And it's exhausting, I know. I've lived it. It's exhausting because you have this mythical number out there that you don't ever know what it is. You never know when you're going to be big enough. But you're always fighting. It's like the horse with a carrot, and you never quite get there, and it's exhausting. And then when the numbers aren't good, you're bummed out. And the numbers are great, you're excited, and that only lasts for a day or two. But when all we have to do is not worry about how we create more people in these chairs, but all we have to do is worry about, all Friar has to do is reduplicate himself. That's it. We allow God to bring the increase. And that's a much better place to be. I was reading, and it's interesting that this was the topic this morning, but I was reading an article last night, just popped across my computer, and it was about a famous actor, and I wasn't personally familiar with him, but he was a famous like child actor in the 90s of some big sitcom, and apparently he's still fairly successful. And the person was talking about people. He's like, you know, when you won Emmys and whatever, you didn't stop. He's like, yeah, why? He kind of laughed at the question. He's like, why would you stop? The Emmy's not the goal. He said, I have no friends in Hollywood, and all they want to do is be famous. But that's all they want to do. They just want to be famous. They want to go to the party. They don't really want to do the work that it takes to get there. And so they never quite get there. He just kind of made fun of them. I know a lot of churches and a lot of people who are Christians, they want to be Christian just so they, you know, can go to the next event, the next rally, the next whatever, and the next exciting thing. They don't want to do the work that it takes to get to where it is. And we don't want to be a church that's like that. We want to be more like the person that has the snowball. It starts out small, and you don't really know how big it's going to get, but you're just going to roll it. And then you roll it some more. And then you roll, and then it grows. You don't have to do the work of creating this big monstrosity snowball to put the base of the snowman there. All you got to do is take a little handful and just start rolling it. And it just keeps going. And so that's the evangelism versus discipleship dichotomy. We don't want to belittle evangelism at all. But we want our focus to be more on discipleship than it is on techniques on how to draw people in. Because the disciples did that. So the second part of this is kind of a come and see versus a go and tell. The disciples experienced both. They came and saw. Jesus said, come follow me. So they came and saw, and they saw for 3 years. And then Jesus said, go and tell. You remember the story, and you may not, but there's a story in the New Testament where Jesus sends out the 70,000, I mean, it's the 70 people from his ministry and says, go. And he said, don't take any, you know, don't take any extra clothes or, you know, any money. Just kind of go and, you know, heal the sick and raise the dead and then come back. And it talks about the excitement that when they came back and saw that God worked in their lives the same way that he was working through Jesus, through healing people and touching their lives. And this was an exciting thing. When Jesus sent them out, their faith grew. If you look back at verse 16, it says, then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. And in verse 17, it says, when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. And then Jesus came and said to them, and then we know what he said. All authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. Now go and make disciples of all nations, baptize them and tell them to obey everything that I commanded, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. But he did that to those who even doubted. Jesus even commissioned, he even sent the ones who doubted. Because Jesus knew that by going, by doing, by experiencing, their faith was going to grow. By getting outside the walls of a church and actually rolling up our sleeves and getting involved in someone's life and seeing God change who they are, doing that kind of stuff changes who we are. Our faith grows. If you remember, Peter is only 2 months removed, roughly, from Jesus' crucifixion, where he denied even knowing Jesus, to standing up on the day of Pentecost and preaching a sermon where 3,000 people came. It wasn't the fact that Peter knew all this stuff and he had this great formula. He went out and did, and God changed his life. His faith grew because of what he did. He experienced Jesus, and that helped. That was the catalytic moment. That was what moved him forward. But his faith, he spent 3 years with Jesus and still denied him. He still doubted. 2 months earlier. But Jesus is gone. They have no one to rely on but themselves and what Jesus told them. So as he's going out and doing, his faith grew. We see this happen in our lives all the time. I told a story a couple weeks ago of, you know, of a paradigm shift where a friend of mine was jumping off of a... Did I tell that story? I don't remember. I'll tell it very quickly. A friend of mine, when I was in college, and we were at a friend's house, and there was a balcony or a patio that was a second-story patio about 7.5 feet away from a pool. But it was like 7.5 feet that way and, you know, 20 feet that way. And so we made jokes about jumping off and doing it. None of us like really thought that would work. Till my friend Gabe runs up the steps and just head first. And we're just watching like, that's dumb. Sending in good. In the water. He jumps up laughing. He runs back up. Before he could, we were all up there. We all doubted at one point until we did it. And I'm like, oh, I can do this. I'm not going to suffer a compound fracture if I do it. You actually make it. Inertia and gravity and all this stuff works together where you hit the pool. Now, I'm not advocating anybody going doing that. Don't do it. We were 19 and dumb, okay? Learn from our mistakes. But that happens in life. We doubt that we can do anything. We doubt we can be parents until we get in the process. It's only the process of doing it that we ever get the faith that we actually maybe can make it to the end of it in one piece. I'm in the middle of it. I still don't know, you know? But every day I'm doing something different. We get behind the wheel of a car when we're 15, 16 years old. It's like, I'm going to. And then we do it, and our faith grows. The same is true with our Christian walk. we do it. We do the things Jesus taught, and we see God be faithful to what he told us he would do, and our faith grows. Quick story. I have a friend. His name's Marty. And Marty is a guy that I met about 4 years ago. And Marty had been a Christian all of his life. He grew up Catholic in New York, in one of the boroughs. I don't know lots of New York, so it's one of the places up there. I want to say Long Island. I could be completely wrong. But Marty grew up there, and he raised a family, and then he moves down here, and he gets involved in a church that I'm working in. And God starts to take and grab hold of Marty's life. And Marty starts to read the Bible. And me and Marty start to have conversations. And he starts to read the Bible. It's like, well, what if Jesus really meant this? Like, what if it wasn't just something nice we said, but what if he really meant? And Marty would just little by little, like, he'd ask me questions and we'd talk through it. And then he would be like, really like, I'm not sure if I want to do this or not. But then he'd do it a little bit. And then he'd grow. His faith began to grow and grow and grow. And just a couple weeks ago, he said, you know what? I know this isn't for everybody, but I feel like God's told me to cash out my retirement. He said, I got a pension. I'm good till I'm 95. He said, what's this money doing here? I feel like if I'm going to be faithful to what God's called me to do, what God's calling me to do is to cash this out and do generous stuff with it. Just go and help people. And so he did. In 4 years, just going and doing, gave Marty this faith to where he could one day just say, I trust God so much, I'm willing to cash this out. Like, I believe it can happen. Now, this is not me advocating, saying you need to do that, okay? God's call to each of us is different. What God's called Friar to do is different than what he maybe has called you guys to do. And only you know that. We like to condemn people a lot because we say, I did this, so it should be good for you. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just telling you Marty's story. But what I want you to understand is 4 years earlier, that would never have been the case. But by going and doing, by rolling that snowball down a little bit, it got bigger and it got bigger and it got bigger to the point where he was willing to say, I got the faith that my retirement's in God's hands. Like, I'm in God. And that takes a lot of faith. It takes a lot of trust. And we don't get there just by making the decision in our mind. We have to act. And so it was this difference between, Jesus knew that there was a difference between going and seeing, coming and seeing and going and telling. The going and telling transformed them. It transformed who Paul was. It transforms who we are. When we go and tell, we can come back and tell stories, and it's amazing. And then the last thing is, there should be confidence when we go. I want to highlight 2 points of the Great Commission that we don't see highlighted very often. And that's the two bookends of what Jesus said. He starts out by saying, all authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and tell. Jesus was telling his disciples, I have the authority. You don't have to worry about having the authority. I have it. If I'm in you, you have it. You can go and be salt and light. Like I told you, we're a church on mission. When Jesus gave his final command, he gave it to the people who were closest to them. He put them on mission. He said, you can go and be salt and light. Remember the sermon I just taught you guys a year or so ago? Where is salt good at? It's good on things, right? Salt 2 inches away from the food is still no good. It's useful on things. Where is light helpful? If I was to turn a little flashlight on in this room right now, it'd be of no use. Power failure? It'd be very useful. That was Jesus' permission that we can go into the world, that he's going to be with us. He has the authority. We can go. We're not supposed to be salt in a shaker 2 feet away. We're supposed to be in it, on it, intimate with it. The light, it's got to be in the darkness. We can't run from church meeting to church meeting to small group meeting to feeding ministry. Run to the feeding ministry, because then we do run into darkness. We do run into areas of need. But light and darkness are 2 different things. One is the absence of light, right? And the way we change that is by turning the light on. Jesus said to go. He didn't say to attract and to draw a crowd. He said, go and make disciples. When the church gets busier creating a come and see environment rather than commissioning people to go and tell them, we're failing Jesus' command. He said, all authority in heaven has been given to me, now go. But then at the end of it, the second thing I want to bring out is that he promises us one thing. He says, and I will be here with you even until the end of the age. What Jesus is saying is, I'm already there. I'm going to be with you. You're not going to go someplace where I'm not. When we go out on mission, we're meeting Jesus there. We're joining Jesus there. And if you don't believe me, I want to tell you a story. This is where this picture comes in. So this is a map. It's a trail map. If you ever, Jim, you'd like it. This is a trail map of northern India. And so this is all northern part of India, and this is Pakistan over here, and you have Nepal over here. And when I was 22 years old, I went and hiked 250 miles through here. This is where I have this map from. And it doesn't look like very long, but we hiked from over here all the way to over here. It took us 2.5 weeks. And what we were doing was we were there with a lady named Anna, who worked for the Baptist Men's Mission something in North Carolina. That's the best title I could come up with at the last minute. I don't really know what it is, but the Men's Baptist. And they did these outreaches in the Himalayas. And so Anna worked for them as a doctor. And what she would do is she'd go to these different Buddhist villages and treat their actual needs. That whole healing thing we talked about last week. There were things they needed they couldn't get. And so she did it. And so, and while she was there, she'd pass out Bibles to the Buddhist monks because they were the only ones who could read. And they collected everything because everything was wisdom and they wanted to gain as much wisdom as they could. So it was kind of a really subversive way to say, here's the gospel, read this. And so that's what we would do. And so when I went there, that's what we did. We started hiking. 2.5 weeks later, we made it to the next road and we got on the bus and we left. But during that hike, we would stop at these Buddhist villages every night and camp and hang out. And we'd do these medical clinics. And then we'd give out Bibles to the monks and we'd leave. And that was really the extent of it. But while we're on this trip, Anna was telling us a story about her getting altitude sickness. And if you get over certain altitudes and you go too fast, too far, too long, whatever, you can get two different types of altitude sickness. One affects your brain and one affects your lungs. It can be very dangerous. And Anna tells us a story of one day when she got altitude sickness. She's, it's a nice way to put that. She's like losing her lunch. I don't know what's the nicest way to put this. I've never had to tell a story from this pulpit of church. She's vomiting, right, on the side of this rock. And when she gets done, she's wiping her mouth and she looks up. And there's a Buddhist monk standing there. Now, Anna told us, she said, I knew for a fact that no one had ever been to this village. This village had never heard about Jesus. We knew this for a fact as we were the first people walking in. And there was a monk standing there. And he looks at me and he said, are you the one that's come to tell us about Jesus? She said, yes, I am. How did you know that? He said, well, a man has come to me and other people in my village in dreams over the last few years and told us that someone was going to come to our village and tell us about a man named Jesus. Are you that person who's come? She said, yes, and they shared the gospel with them. God was there before they got there. He is on mission when we go. There's a pastor, the guy who came up with a change for a dollar out in Portland. He tells the story of when their church was really young and it was, you know, real small. It was only like 20 people, and they were doing this outreach to this apartment complex, and it was full of single addicted moms. And there was a rehab center for him. And he was sitting with one of these moms, and she was a Christian. And he was asking her stories. He said, when did you come to know Christ? And her answer was that it was when my friend, who was addicted to heroin, told me about Jesus the day before he OD'd. Jesus was working through the life of this heroin-addicted person. Jesus is working through dreams in India. Jesus is there with us before we go. When we go, we are meeting Jesus on mission. He promised us this in Matthew 28, verse 20. I will be with you always, even to the end of the age. He's already there. So our going and telling is just announcing the kingdom of God, pointing people to Christ and loving people, because that's what Christ did. That was his mission. And he gave it to us before he left. There was an idea, and I'm going to close with this, in Rwanda. I spent 2 weeks there a couple summers ago. And if you remember, in 94, there was a genocide, and 1 million people died in 90 days. And so there was lots of healing, obviously, that needed to happen, lots of restoration. And he said, when we went in, and this man runs a Bible college and seminary training school for pastors. He is, well, he's not Rwandan, but he's from an African country close by, Congo, I think. I can't remember now. But he said, we had to go in with a two-handed gospel. And that's what he builds his Bible school office idea of, a two-handed gospel. Because he said, with one hand, we were doing the evangelism thing. Like, we were sharing Jesus. But with the other hand, we actually had to bandage their wounds and pick up the pieces and help them carry on. That is what this discipleship thing is. It's a two-handed gospel where we are extending Christ to people, but we're also embracing who they are. If we're going to be in this discipleship thing, if we believe that multiplication is the way to go, and I think it is, our call as a church is to be this two-handed gospel, to go and to tell. Yeah, we're telling Jesus, but then we're getting in and do the dirty work of discipling them, showing them what it is to follow Christ, to pray with trust, to call other people, to feed other people, to heal other people, to commission other people. And if we can do that, that's all we have to do. We don't have to then worry about, well, what do we need to do to make Mosaic relevant and easily? I think the question should be, what do we do to make God relevant and easily in the upstate? Amen? Let's pray.